and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host tonight, Kay Poppy. Here in the studio with me tonight is professor and historian of astronomy, Dr. Jim Lattice. And he is here to talk about his new book called Chasing the Stars, which documents the history of the Wisconsin Observatory here at UW-Madison campus. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Kate. I appreciate the invitation.
So I thought we could start out by talking about the song, It's Dark on Observatory Hill. Where did this song come from?
Well, it has its roots. One of the writers of the song was a student here. He didn't graduate, but then he went on to work in songwriting and wrote the lyrics to "It's Dark on Observatory Hill," and said later that it was about our Observatory Hill. Now, there's a lot of observatories and observatory hills in the world, but he was a student from here. And said that he had written about it, but he was no astronomer. It's about the social life of students on the campus and the importance of Observatory Hill as a rendezvous place for young couples.
And there's a funny story in the book talking about some of the astronomers getting a little bit annoyed with all of the traffic, as it was known as Lover's Lane.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was definitely becoming an issue for the astronomers. Cars. We're talking in the very late 1920s and very early 30s, and it's puzzled me a little bit. I'd like to know why suddenly so many students had cars on campus. I'm not sure whether it's the Depression or what's going on there, but for some reason, anyway. Students would with their girlfriends would drive up to the top of the hill, and. It's a beautiful overlook if you've ever been up there. It's a beautiful view out over the lake. And of course, it was darker in those days than it used to be. But more importantly, the road, Observatory Drive, took a different route than it does today and went right next to the observatory building, just a few feet away from the observatory building. And so the traffic and the lights from the cars was an issue. And there was a certain amount of moral outrage going on there as well. But the ignition systems of old automobiles actually produced electrical noise that was measurable. They were measuring electrical signals from faint stars up there at the observatory. And the electrical noise from the ignitions of those ancient automobiles was detectable in the observatory instruments. So it was actually interfering with the actual astronomical observing, quite aside from being something of a nuisance. So yeah, it was a deal for a little while. The end result was that they relocated Observatory Drive down the hill about 100 feet away from the building.
Yeah, and I asked this because I think you said in the book that part of the reason that the observatory was built there was because of the beautiful scenic overlook. So we'll get into that. But I first want to ask, who is the Washburn Conservatory named after, observatory, I should say, and what was his vision for the research at UW-Madison?
Well, yeah, excellent question. So Washburn is a reference to Cadwallader Colden Washburn, who was he was originally from Maine and came to Wisconsin when he was as a young man seeking his fortune. He didn't really have much education. He had a basic education, but managed to build several businesses in Wisconsin, including at one point a banking business and at one point a shot tower, that is a lead shot tower out in Mineral Point. But lumbering is where he first started making a lot of money. He actually worked as a land agent and meaning representing the interests of land owners who were all East Coast investors for the most part. But that got him into lumbering and ultimately into flour milling. And he made a lot of money with flour mills, which was the predecessor of the company we know as General Mills. So it was a very successful company. It was called the Washburn, of course, Washburn Crosby Milling Company. He was governor of Wisconsin from 1872 to 1874 and then did not win the election reelected and lost. And at that point basically decided to get out of business and politics and devote himself to philanthropy. So he made a number of major gifts, including, for example, funding an orphanage in the Twin Cities and funding the public library in La Crosse, where he actually lived. And he wanted to give a gift to the University of Wisconsin. And he probably had several ideas about what that might be. We know at least that he had at one point discussed building a library for the university. But the influence of John Bascom is very important here, the president of the university at the time. Bascom had an agenda, which was to move the University of Wisconsin in the direction of what we now call a research university. And you need research institutions. So his idea was that if if the university had an observatory, that would promote this this direction for the mission of the university. And Washburn agreed to that. So basically, Washburn, with no astronomical background or anything, started building an observatory for the university as a gift to the university, and as he would sometimes say, to the state.
And could you talk about the telescope that he wanted built there?
Right. So this goes back to the research, the research idea. Washburn, again, a very successful businessman, had a pretty clear idea of how it is that you position yourself, how you promote yourself. And so he wanted to make sure that the observatory he was building for the university would rank in the top rank of institutions in the country. So he wanted our telescope to be comparable or better than the telescope at Harvard University. So Harvard was already at that time sort of a paragon of a research university, one of the early ones moving in that direction. So he wanted to position the University of Wisconsin, basically wanted to establish the pretension that we would compete as a world-class research university. So that really came down to the size of the telescope, because that's how observatories were always ranked, to some extent still are. Harvard had the third largest telescope in the country at the time, which had a lens that's 15 inches in diameter. So Washburn paid for a 15.5-inch telescope, which made us then outrank Harvard. So we pushed Harvard down to fourth, and we were the third largest observatory in the country when our telescope was installed in January of 1879.
And we're moving fast here, of course. There's so much to talk about, but I was hoping you could talk a little bit about Edward Holden and how he scheduled the first and third Wednesdays for public visitor nights, a tradition that still lives on today. Could you explain how this affected public interest in astronomy?
Well, it does go back to Holden, and it's fairly unusual. Observatories at that time did not routinely have public visitor nights. And they, for example, Harvard was kind of notorious for saying, no, what we're doing here is way too important to let the public interrupt our work and things like that. But Edward Holden was an interesting guy. He's an astronomer who was very interested in popularizing science. Again, something you don't find a lot among professional astronomers we're talking the 1880s here. And Holden would later establish the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, for example, which was a deliberate effort to involve professional astronomers and amateur astronomers together. He also collaborated with professional science writers and wrote popular articles of his own. So anyway, it's entirely in character that as director here, he was actually the second director here at Washburn Observatory, that in the spring of 1881, which is basically when the observatory was actually finished, the construction pretty much came to an end and was fully equipped. Almost fully equipped. That's when Holden announced, actually published in the newspaper, that the observatory would be open to the public on the first and third Wednesday nights of the month, with the explicit provision that please leave us alone the rest of the time. So it's very transactional sort of thing. We'll open up the observatory on a regular basis. The astronomers will be here. You can look through the big telescope and all that stuff. But the rest of the time, please don't come around knocking at the door at night, because it interrupts our work. So that, as far as I know, is the oldest program, at least the oldest ongoing program of visitor nights in the United States. The only other observatory that had a strong tradition in that way was the Paris Observatory, where there were astronomers there who were very interested in popularizing science and things like that. Whether Holden had that in mind, I don't know as a precedent. But among U.S. observatories, it's very hard to find anybody who's had a longer an older program of regular access to the public, which is a considerable fraction if you think about it. That's two nights out of the month. You only have 30 to do your research on. So that's like 1/15 of the available time that astronomers could be looking at the sky, weather permitting, obviously. So it was a big deal.
Yeah, I can imagine the public was really interested and became even more interested as they learned more.
There are certainly news reports from the day that, and that may have been a partial motivation too, that people were just coming up to the observatory and banging on the door at night. And so trying to have this transactional aspect is clearly recognizing that. But there are newspaper accounts in some cases of reporters who were frustrated that they weren't admitted to report to be admitted to the building even after this policy had been enacted. But it did. It was a big deal when it was first installed, as you might imagine. I mean, they hosted all kinds of VIPs up there. The state legislature, they wanted to come up and look through the telescope, and the Supreme Court wanted to come look through the telescope, and so on. And you know, important people and their families all were trying to get access to the telescope too. So it was quite the thing there for a while.
Yeah, and he also established the timekeeping service. Could you explain a little bit about what that was?
Sure. So that was a very common role historically for observatories, really up until relatively recent times, because until the early 1960s, I think it was when time was defined by atomic transitions, hence atomic clocks and things like that. Before that, time was defined astronomically by you could think of it as the when the sun crosses the meridian, that's noon. And so at the moment that happens, that's local noon for you. It was actually much more accurately determined by stars crossing the meridian, which were observed by astronomers with special instruments at night. So the timekeeping goes back, the best known and longest one perhaps is Greenwich Observatory, where they have very famously, everybody knows the ball that drops in Times Square on New Year's Day. The ball dropped every day at noon at Greenwich Observatory. So the astronomers set their clocks by the stars, and then these would have been the most accurate clocks, and then they would send a signal in the form of the ball dropping to indicate that that's noon, which was largely for the benefit of navigators on ships who were setting sail, had to set their chronometers before sailing. So the U.S. Naval Observatory, where Holden was before he came here, was establishing a time service, but these things were done regionally in those days. And so when Holden came here, he set about establishing a time service. What that really means is that there's a master clock at the observatory, which they would have anyway, that would be set astronomically by observations of the stars, which they would do anyway. But then you set it up so that the master clock sets what's called a standard time clock, because the observatory clocks would be sidereal clocks, a solar standard time clock, and that clock is set up to send out telegraph signals at a certain time of day. And so anybody who subscribed to the time service they'd have to be a telegraph office of some sort. So the railroads were well set up for this kind of thing, and they were the ones who paid the most for it. You connect your receiver to the telegraph line at the right time, and you hear ticks coming from the observatory clock. And then when the hour hits, you set your clock to the hour there. And that was very important especially for railroads, because they needed accurate times to keep their trains from running into each other out on the tracks. But it was also very useful for business people, finance people. There was a clock, an observatory controlled clock up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And it brought in considerable fees that were a considerable fraction of the total amount of the operating budget of the observatory, allowed them to do some things that they couldn't otherwise do, say hire some observing assistants and acquire some equipment and things like that. That business only lasted until about the turn of the century, when just another observatory time service, namely the U.S. Naval Observatory, more or less came to dominate those things across the country. But we were a regional time service, basically from the Mississippi over to the other side of Lake Michigan. The Washburn Observatory was a major provider of time signals.
And Madison became famous for research in photometry. Could you explain a little bit about what that is and why it was significant?
Sure. So the you can sort of divide the history of astronomy at Wisconsin into several sort of epochs. And in the earliest one, they were doing old style observing, which is what everybody was doing in those days, where the astronomer is actually looking through the eyepiece of the telescope and making certain measurements. But we also start talking about astrophysics at a certain point, which is sort of a different set of concerns and questions and techniques that astronomers that became basically, almost universal in astronomy by the early 20th century. And that was the advent of astrophysics here came in about 1920, when the fourth director of Washburn Observatory brought an experimental technique here that he'd been working on when he was previously the director of the observatory at the University of Illinois. And he'd been working with these very experimental devices called photoelectric photometers that could just barely produce an electrical signal from starlight and thus allow you to measure, to quantitatively investigate the brightness and compare the brightnesses of stars one to another, or given a variable star as it varies over time, for example. So that's called photoelectric photometry, and that fourth director who was named Joel Stebbins. Stebbins was one of the very few people in the U.S. who was interested in that technology, almost the only astronomer who was interested in that sort of thing, which was not something astronomers are trained to do. We're basically talking about early electronics. If you think about a radio, if you can imagine what a radio in 1920 looked like. We're talking about electronics of that era. Astronomers were not trained to deal with that sort of thing. Stebbins was willing to learn how that kind of stuff worked and then to work with physicists who were the people that knew how those things worked. So he would team up with physicists both at Illinois and later at Wisconsin to employ these instruments to measure starlight. And because he was basically the only guy in the U.S. doing this, and there were really only a couple of others in Europe who were experimenting with these techniques, he pretty much had the field to himself and did a lot of important early investigations in work on, for example, binary star systems. Eclipsing binaries are a particular type of star system from which astronomers can learn a lot if you can quantitatively measure the changes in the brightness of the star system as these eclipses, so-called, happen. But he was able to do that, became very productive in determining, for example, the masses. You can actually come up with the masses of stars that way. Well, one of the things that that astrophysics is most interested in is how do stars work? And knowing fundamental properties about them, like their masses, is very important in that sort of thing. So this kind of work was really important in early astrophysics, and it basically started here, and we continued to dominate astronomical, that is we, when I say we, the University of Wisconsin and Washburn Observatory, dominated that kind of work until well after World War II. So there was a long era in there when Washburn Observatory was the place you went to learn about astronomical photoelectric photometry.
And could you explain how Stebbins shrunk the galaxy and expanded the nebula,
sure,
as explained in the book, and how what that has to do with photometry?
Sure. Well, because another thing that you can do with photometry, besides measuring the brightness of an object, say comparing one object to another, or comparing the brightness of a star at one time or another, you can also measure the difference between the brightness of a star in one part of the visual spectrum compared to another. So you might look at it through a blue filter and measure with your photometer. You get a number out of that, out of your instrument. And then you switch to a yellow filter and you make the same sort of measurement. And the difference between those two, literally subtracting one from the other, is called a color index. So reddish stars, the signal from the yellow through the yellow filter will be greater than through the blue, whereas bluish stars will be the opposite case. The difference will go the other way. So by making those measurements, you come up with a color index for stars or any other object that you might want to look at. Well, the relevance to the galaxy came about because one way of trying to establish the size of the galaxy in which we live, and I'll skip it, but I just want to acknowledge that even that word galaxy was evolving at that time, the fact that we lived in an island of stars, a big assemblage of stars, of which there are others, was a new idea at the time. Well, at any rate, one idea about this had been based on measuring the distances to star clusters, called globular clusters, that surround our galaxy. But it turns out that you can't just look at a star cluster and establish their distance based on how dim they are. Because the farther away they are, the dimmer they're going to be. And that was one way that their distances had been estimated, to oversimplify enormously. And so the size of the distribution of this halo globular clusters was used to infer the size of the galaxy. Stebbins was able to show that, in fact, space is not empty, but that there's an awful lot of what we now call interstellar matter. And that also weakens the light from distant objects. And you have to take that into account or you get the wrong distance. He could measure that by the reddening, by this color index measuring. By calibrating that on stars in the galaxy, he was able to apply then those corrections to those globular cluster distances. And the previous estimates that the galaxy was something like 300,000 light years in diameter came out to be more like 100,000 light years in diameter, which is still the current number that you'll read in an astronomy textbook. So this general picture of our galaxy came from up there at Washburn Observatory. Well, that's when Stebbins declared that he shrunk the galaxy, or we shrunk the galaxy, is what he's quoted as saying by somebody who was up at the observatory at the time. This would have been it's actually undated, but it would have been probably about 1932 or so around in there. This is important because he's offering a completely new view of the galaxy. Not only is it a lot smaller than the previous models were showing, but the previous models were assuming that space was transparent, that there's nothing between the stars. Well, if there's nothing between the stars, that's going to be a very different sort of picture. The modern idea of galaxies is that all that stuff between the stars is where stars come from, and where matter from exploding stars, for example, goes back to. And our general ideas about star formation and planet formation in part come from our understanding of this interstellar matter. Well, Stebbins was the first guy to actually quantify the distribution and nature of that matter, which he did by measuring those color indices with his photometers.
So if I'm getting it right, the further away stars are going to be more red and the closer will be more blue. Is that right?
A given star, if you're looking through more interstellar matter at a given star, then it will be reddened compared to what its color would be if you didn't have that intervening matter. Now, what Stebbins found was that it's extremely clumpy and non-uniform. He was able to map it, but only by mapping individual stars all around the whole plane of the Milky Way. If you're looking in the plane of the Milky Way, then yes, the more distant stars, you'll be looking through more stuff. Out of the plane of the galaxy, he found out that there was very little effect, which showed that the interstellar matter was closely confined to the plane of the galaxy in a very thin layer. He used to compare to a popular audience this structure of the galaxy. He said, think of a ham sandwich, and so the bun that the ham sandwich is made out of, the bread, that's the distribution of stars. But then you've got this thin slice of ham, and that's the interstellar matter. It's right in the plane of the galaxy. And when you're looking through it out that way, it has a big effect. But if you look out of the plane of it, then it has very little effect. And he was able to map that effect and then make those kinds of corrections based on that.
Cool. So moving along in history, in 1965, the Pine Bluff Observatory housed the only robotic telescope in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a big deal. The first robotic telescope, although I have heard the old guys debate what's a robotic telescope. So there are others who would like to claim that as well. But yeah, we do claim that out at Pine Bluff Observatory, we had an automatic telescope working that could could operate for several days on its own, observing a list of stars. That was largely associated with the planning here for the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory, which would operate. We built one of the two major instruments for that. And the whole idea was that instrument was going to have to operate in a mode like that. So build one on the ground and make sure you know how that works before you put one in orbit.
Right. So what did that have an impact on when we started doing research in space? How did that have an impact?
Well, so space astronomy, that's the third sort of major epoch. If I'm thinking about how the history of the observatory goes, you have this early eyeball at the eyepiece kind of era, and then you have the early astrophysics and the photoelectric photometry. And then in the space age, expertise here at Wisconsin in electronics and photoelectric photometry was perfect for adaptation to space-based instruments. And there was a huge motivation to do that once it became possible, basically in the post-Sputnik era when there was the space race and we were putting stuff in orbit around the Earth. Why not put some telescopes in orbit around the Earth too, was NASA's thinking. And the big advantage of that is that it opens up the electromagnetic spectrum, which our Earth's atmosphere limits us to. For example, ultraviolet radiation is blocked by Earth's atmosphere largely, but ultraviolet radiation tells us a lot about how stars operate, just to stick with stars. And so the motivation was very strong to put telescopes above the Earth's atmosphere and explore the ultraviolet universe.
Great. Well, we are almost out of time, which time is going by really fast. So I'm going to ask one more question, and I'm curious, in the book, is there anything that you think is particularly interesting or anything that people miss that you think is important that you want to talk about here?
Well, my co-author Kelly and I do see this book very much as conveying to people the importance of the contributions of the University of Wisconsin to the way that we view the universe today, and the contributions of the university in various fields of research are to some extent represented by what happened here. The early 20th century was an amazing period of contributions from the university in research growing up in various different various directions in physics and in agricultural sciences and so on. And including radio broadcasting, of course. I would hope that people take away from this the idea that really important things happened here, and that Wisconsin and the University of Wisconsin have made huge contributions to the way that we view the world and the way that we understand the universe today. I don't know if anybody's missing that, but that's one of the things that we certainly wanted to convey out of here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here. It was so much fun, and I learned a lot. So encourage people
to read the book. My pleasure. The time just flies.
And you've been listening to The Perpetual Notion Machine. This was our guest, Professor Jim Lattice, talking about his new book, Chasing the Stars.
Now it's dark on Observatory Hill. Come on, let's pretend we're Jack and Jill. We'll stroll to the hilltop where college sweethearts go to look at the lights on the campus down below. We'll learn what astronomy is for, and we'll learn what the stars can have in store. I know in advance that the moon may mean romance when it's dark on Observatory Hill. And I'd like to recite you a poem that I wrote. It tells why I think you're wonderful. And from afar we can hear a sweet guitar while voices are harmonizing. You don't have to know arithmetic just to figure why you and I would click. My heart tells me this, your lips were meant to kiss, and it's dark on Observatory Hill.